Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet distinguished Professor Paul Kirschner in this episode. Paul has an international reputation for his work on education and a clear sense of how education is best designed. His insight into instruction, questioning, and learning made this interview particularly stimulating. Paul and I talked via Skype. So it's my privilege to be talking with distinguished Professor Paul Kirschner of the Open University of the Netherlands. Paul is editor of the Journal of Computer-Assisted Learning and has a rich history of scholarship across a broad spectrum of subjects, which we'll no doubt hear more about during this interview. Paul, it's great to be talking with you today.
No, it's great to be talking to you. Thank you very, very much for interviewing me.
Paul, can we start with just a brief overview of your career and publications?
My career began in the United States in the 1960s, where I studied psychology and got a teacher's degree for maths and sciences, left the United States and spent a number of hippie years traveling around the Netherlands, Europe, and the Indian subcontinent. And then in the end of the 70s, 76, went back to the university in the Netherlands to get my master's in educational psychology. And I majored there. My area of expertise, which has been kind of like the red line through the rest of my career, is in something called text characteristics and learning processes. Specifically is what can you do with the text to influence the way someone studies from it or studies it, and assuming that differences in the way you study something will have an effect on how you learn from it. I started doing research on the use of adjunct questions, as they were called, in textual and videotape learning materials. And in the rest of my life, I've constantly been busy with how can you adapt, present instructional materials in such a way that it will facilitate certain types of learning, the types of learning that you want to achieve. That's kind of what I've always been busy with. And that can be different learning strategies, let's say retrieval practice in texts. It can be the use of podcasts. I've done research on that and with epistemic questions before someone attends a lecture. It can be with the use of different types of feedback, audio and videotaped feedback for people who have done writing essays. It can be with typographical accentuation. All of these different things, but that's always been the red line through all of my work from the time I was a master's student at the University of Amsterdam up until now.
So, Paul, at the risk of trying to cut through what is a very big body of work, what are some of the core tips you would pass across to people seeking to make the most of questions and the most of text in online education?
The most important thing with that is knowing what you want your people to learn, what your students to learn. When you ask questions, just as like when you make use of learning objectives, you have two types of learning, intentional and incidental learning. And often it's the case that people will learn exactly what you ask them, and that's the intentional learning, often at the cost of incidental learning, the rest of the text. So it's very, very important to be able to mix your the types of questions so that you achieve the type of learning that you want to achieve. If you constantly ask, that's one of my mentors was Ernst of Ernie Rothkopf from Bell Laboratories. He had this idea of mathemagenic activities. Those are activities that give birth to learning. And the idea there was if you ask, for example, certain types of questions, you'll shape or model the type of reading and thinking when someone's studying. And in that way, you'll affect the way that that person learns and what that person learns. So if you constantly ask application questions prior to having someone read the text, you'll shape his or her behavior into reading it in a way that he or she will constantly think of how can I apply it? Whereas if you constantly ask factual questions, either prior to or after, you'll shape their way of learning into trying to remember the facts. So if you're dealing with questions prompting those types of things, you have to realize that while you might have a positive effect in certain types of learning, you can have a negative effect in other types of learning. So that it's not that simple to just say, well, ask good questions and people will learn better, because you have to ask yourself, do you want them to learn a certain type of thing, possibly, which might be not advantageous to learning other types of things? And you can do that with all different types. You can do it with questions. You can do it with giving learning objectives. You can do it with the way you zoom in on certain things in video learning material. All of those types of things have an effect on the way someone studies and eventually the way someone learns.
It's almost like a Socratic approach to education, perhaps, knowing the right questions to ask in order to elicit the right sort of thinking.
Exactly. My idea behind this is you as the teacher are kind of like the doctor. You work prescriptively because you know what it is that you want people to be able to do at the end. And so you have to choose the therapy that best fits to achieve the goals you want to achieve. I'm very much an instructivist, as it's called, and not a constructivist. My idea is that the teacher is an expert in at least three different fields, and those are the techniques of good instruction and learning, the tools needed for good instruction and learning, and the ingredients. And those ingredients are things like the type of question you use, up to and including the domain-specific aspects of what someone is teaching or should be learning. I often make a analogy with a top chef. A top chef has knowledge of techniques, tools, and ingredients to make delicious, nutritious, and good-looking meals, has a very deep conceptual knowledge of all of those things and also the skills needed to make use of them. And a top teacher has deep conceptual knowledge and finely honed skills in the tools, techniques, ingredients of good teaching and instruction to make that learning effective, enjoyable, and efficient. Teaching and instruction is a design science, and you have to make use of good empirical evidence to learn to instruct properly. Constructivism is a philosophy, and it's a philosophy that states we all see and interpret the world based upon what we've experienced. We construct our own reality. It's true. My way of looking at something is completely different than yours and completely different from just about everyone else's, because I've had different experiences in my life. I have different knowledge. And as such, what I see is different from what you see. If I walk with a geologist in the mountains of France, I, being avid bicyclist, will see gear ratios, climbing percentages, and things like that. My friend is a geologist, and he sees geological time periods. He sees fossils, different types of rock formations. What we know determines what we see. So constructivism as a philosophy is something that is true. Let's put it that way. Constructivism isn't a pedagogy and isn't a psychology of learning. It's not a pedagogy of teaching. It's a philosophy of being. Research shows that motivation doesn't lead to learning. Learning success leads to motivation. If you're motivated to do something, but you constantly hit your head against the wall because through trial and error, things go wrong, you don't get things right, you don't get the right answer, you don't do it properly, you will eventually lose that motivation and say with attribution, I can't do it. It's not something for me. If you achieve success and you get this kind of feeling of self-efficacy, I can do it, that will lead to continuing in what you're doing to learn more. So it's not even a fact that it's a reciprocal relationship. It's a causal relationship. Learning success leads to motivation. I often take the example of a young soccer player, footballer, who wants to learn to bend it like Beckham. And he or she is standing there in front of a cardboard wall of defenders and is kicking the ball and kicking the ball and kicking the ball, and it's constantly going into the wall. And every once in a while, he or she kicks it in a way that gives it kind of a curve and maybe even goes around the wall, but he or she has no idea what was done to achieve that. Now, you just take a good instructor and you put the instructor next to that child and you say, well, if you want it to curve in this way, you have to hit it with the outside part of your foot so that you get a spin in this direction. But if you want it to curve the other way, you have to hit it with the inside arch of your foot to make it curve that way. Hmm. And within a couple of tries, that child will then see that the ball is beginning to get a curve in it. And the kid thinks, hey, I can do it. Wow, it's curving, it's moving. And then the teacher says, okay, that's really, really good. But if you want to get more, you have to not approach it from the back, but maybe more from the side so you get more.
Yeah.
And that success will lead to wanting to learn. Whereas if that child just does it, is motivated to learn without good instruction, that child will eventually get a very, very tired and sore foot and leg and eventually come to the conclusion, I can't do it. Fun is great. Motivation is great, but it's about instruction. And you can make instruction fun, and you can motivate students beforehand to start on something, but you have to keep them motivated by having them experience success.
It's really refreshing, actually, hearing your educational background come through there. It's clear that you're not distracted by technology, but the fundamental realities of what works in education from an instructional perspective guide your practice. I think it's a message that's really, really important, because quite often in online education, it is easy to get carried away with the technology, carried away with the analytics, carried away with the media that we can use. But what you're saying is we need to think in terms of instruction. What are the learning outcomes?
It's not new. It goes back to Dick Clark, in 1983, in his landmark Review of Educational Research article on the use of media, in which the message is, it's the instruction and not the medium. Mm. It's all about how the pedagogy, more in Dutch, we say the didactics, the educational techniques. I mean, I know that didactic in Anglo-Saxon countries often means standing in front of the classroom and giving a lecture. But in Dutch, didactics is the art of instruction and teaching.
Paul, you've no doubt caught up with MOOCs, and you're no doubt a contemporary observer of how online education is taking shape. It's now late 2018. We're about to enter into 2019. What are your observations about online education at the moment?
That it can be very, very helpful. It often is very, very helpful, but it's not a very efficient approach to teaching instruction, because of the fact that there's so much dropout often with online education.
Yeah.
People have the idea that since you can reach large groups, let's reach large groups. But Dave Wiley, years and years ago, said the limiting factor of online education is bandwidth. And that's not the bandwidth of the computer, but the bandwidth of the instructor. Online education tends to try to achieve economies of scale, but in trying to achieve economies of scale, loses the personal contact between the teacher and the student, and as such, is often not very effective or very efficient. And going into my third part, is also for the learner not very enjoyable, because they miss certain, let's say, social aspects of learning. So although it is possible to learn through online teaching, although it is sometimes even the only way to reach certain groups of people, it's not, at this moment, still not a very effective, efficient, or enjoyable mode of learning. And that's possibly because we're not making optimal use of the media, or making improper use of the media that we have. But if I'm making use of it to try to get to larger groups, if I'm making use of a talking head with videotaped lectures in which there's absolutely no interaction with the students and things like that, then you can say, now, what's the difference of doing it online or doing it through a television? Mm-hmm. The only difference is online, you can do it whenever you want to. But now with television, you can do that also. I mean, Netflix, you can watch anything at any time. So what's the difference? So how are you making use of it? How are you creating social presence with those people that you're working with? And even if it's collaborative learning in small groups, how do you create the social presence? How do you create the intimacy? How do you deal with non audio or visual cues that you normally have in a typical environment. How do you even stop the person in an online situation of, instead of interacting, looking at his or her Facebook account while you're talking to them? The question is, if you only have 300 or 400, and that's a large group, my question is always, is that even more effective than giving a lecture in a lecture hall, in which I'm standing in the front and I have 300 or 400 students and can still interact with them in a way that I can't interact with 300 or 400 students that are following me online?
Yeah.
We don't have the tools at the moment to allow us to achieve the same effects with online education as with face-to-face.
Mm. These are challenges, of course, that have dogged distance education for a number of years as well.
Yes.
How to get the teacher, the expert, to engage with each individual in a way that actually helps the individual achieve the learning outcomes. There are some good approaches used in distance education to help achieve that. And, of course, in the Open University of the Netherlands, you'll be well in touch in terms of how the Netherlands does things. Yes. Are those same approaches also applicable to online, or do the same challenges apply to distance education?
Yes, because we are a distance education institute. We do have very interactive sessions with groups of students. We have dedicated software to do that. That's no problem. But of course, if I'm sitting there in front of a group and it's usually 15 or 20 students, that's just a completely different situation than if I see them in 15 little boxes on my screen, because they all have their computers open and I have no idea what they're doing behind those computers. It's those types of situations. I mean, it's getting better. But if I have my choice, I'd prefer face-to-face than online. Although there are certain reasons for doing online that you can't achieve with face-to-face. Open University is spread throughout all of the Netherlands, which means sometimes the students can be 300 to 400 kilometers apart, and it's very, very hard to get everybody at the same place at the same time, and it's a lot easier to do it through distance education. These are also people who work often during the day or have a family, and you do things in the evening. All of those things allow us to achieve other types of students and be effective and efficient in a different type of way, but that's in terms of the population that you're trying to achieve. Mm. And we try to make the materials as advanced and as self-teaching as possible.
Yeah.
So that a part of the load or part of the job of teaching is taken over by the materials themselves.
Right, and that's where you really work on questions and eliciting the right sort of thinking in students, sort of brings
exactly.
us full circle.
Yeah. Making good use of I know I'm going off on a tangent, but making good use of the tools, the techniques, and the ingredients. The tool, you can say, is a podcast.
Yeah.
The technique, you can say, is a type of advanced organizer. And the ingredient is the epistemic question to create a listening framework, a thinking framework, before someone starts doing something.
Brilliant.
Those are the tools, techniques, and ingredients that make up a part of your teaching, and here your distance teaching.
And that would be an example of being instructionist.
That is being an instructionist. Yeah. As an instructionist, I choose the proper tool, I choose the proper pedagogical technique, and I choose the proper ingredient for that to achieve a certain type of learning.
Brilliant. And that's learning design really wrapped up, isn't it?
That is learning design.
Brilliant. Paul, I'd like to raise a speculative question with you for a while. Imagine you had an unlimited budget and you could do the research that you most wanted to. You could answer the question that perhaps is most important to you, one that you've always been curious about. If you could do that, what research would you most like to see?
I've done quite a lot of research on collaborative learning, specifically also computer-supported collaborative learning. As a matter of fact, I used to have a learning chair in computer-supported collaborative learning. I've also done quite a lot of research on cognitive load theory.
Yeah.
One of the last things I wrote was a conceptual article on how you can bring collaborative load theory, which is a theory of how the individual learns and the individual's cognitive architecture, to a theory of collaborative cognitive load theory.
Mm-hmm.
Because when people learn and work together, there's extra load caused by the transactive or transactional activities that are endemic to collaborative learning. And those transactional activities that comes from the world of economics are the activities for communication and coordination of activities. Communication about the activities that you're carrying out as a group and coordination of activities.
Yeah.
If I'm working alone, I don't have those extra costs. Yeah, they could call transaction costs. I don't have them because I'm doing it alone. I don't have to communicate with someone about what I'm doing and enough to collaborate with them. But if I'm working with other people, I have to communicate and collaborate with them, okay? Which means that there are extra costs above the normal costs that you have seen from a cognitive load perspective. That means that learning becomes more difficult sometimes in a collaborative learning situation because of these extra costs.
Mm.
So on the one hand, you have to think about how do I mitigate those costs? For example, can I train teams to work together before they start working on a learning task so that they already have experience collaborating and communicating with each other, for example? And on the other hand, how do I design a task that is complex enough that requires people to collaborate? Because if you can just as easily do it alone, you won't collaborate because you don't want to pay those extra costs.
Mm.
So I'd like to do research on how do I prime groups to have them learn and coordinate and communicate before they start a learning task, and how do you design tasks that are complex enough to require students to collaborate, because all too often teachers create collaborative tasks that aren't complex enough. A second is dealing with distance teaching and learning, and that I'm also busy with some colleagues, and it was also an idea of mine, and that is we have an incredibly good theory of multimedia learning, Rich Mayer, Roxana Moreno's cognitive theory of multimedia learning. Great theory, based upon cognitive load theory, on the one hand, from John Sweller, and Alan Pavio's dual coding theory. And Rich Mayer brought those two things together perfectly, and he has a great theory, cognitive theory of multimedia learning. At the moment, we're making a lot of use of multimedia for assessment. The only problem is we don't have a good cognitive theory of multimedia assessment, which means we're often just doing things that we hope or think work, or we're making use of the cognitive theory of multimedia learning for assessment. But there's a large difference between learning and assessment.
Yeah.
In learning, you want to facilitate, ease, make the learning process less difficult. Whereas in the assessment situation, you want students to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff. So you actually want to make it more difficult, more diffuse, more obtuse,
yeah,
so that you know that the students have learned what they had to learn, that they're capable of differentiating between things that might seem similar on the surface, but are quite different underneath, which means you need a completely different theory of multimedia assessment. Now, we don't have one of those, so what we see is people using the cognitive theory of multimedia learning, so making the tasks easier, so you really don't know if the students have learned, or they're just translating that which was on paper to something on screen, but paper is a completely different medium, or adding quite a lot of extra bells and whistles that are non-functional either in the learning or in the assessment mode. So we need a good theory of that. So if you gave me the money, I think that would be the second project.
Fantastic. Actually, coming back to your first one, I was reminded by the work of Rupert Wegerif on Dialogic.
Yes.
Yes, it sounds quite similar to what you were proposing there.
In a certain way.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. Thank you, Paul. Two very, very interesting projects there to ruminate on. I approached this last question with some trepidation. Two people you'd recommend as legends and leaders of online learning, one whose work has particularly influenced you, someone else who might be a rising star in terms of what you've come across.
I could give you at least two names. One of them would be David Wiley.
Yes.
He's busy with online learning. As I said, he's the person who came up with the idea of teacher bandwidth. And he's in the Open Educational Resources Movement, which is fairly closely aligned to online learning. So I would definitely say, talk to David and give him my love. A second person that you might want to talk to about it would, of course, be Rich Mayer from the Cognitive Theory of Multimedia Learning, would be a good person to talk to. You're going to be in New Zealand soon, almost in the same time zone. Talk to John Sweller about cognitive load theory and how that might be useful or present problems for online learning. Because for me, online learning is, I mean, I've often said computer-supported collaborative learning is actually the wrong, CSCL is the wrong acronym in the wrong order. It's about learning collaboratively supported by computers. And number one is learning.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk to people about online learning, you need people who are not so much the online side, the medium side, but more on the learning side, who look at learning and then look at how does online learning relate to how good learning should take place.
Yeah.
None of those are rising stars. They're real stars, yeah, real leaders. And for me, are legends.
Brilliant. Thank you. I've often wrestled with what you've just talked about, too, with regards to TEL, technology enhanced learning, because, again, the learning comes last.
Yes.
It should really be learning enhanced by technology.
Exactly. And people, by doing it as TEL, by doing it as CSCL, you see that the emphasis is often on the medium.
Yes.
Whereas the emphasis should be on the learning. It's not, we have this medium, how can we use it for learning? No, we have this, to, we want to get this type of learning, and how can the medium play a facilitative role in this?
Brilliant, brilliant. And that's, I think, a really good way of wrapping up the conversation. Paul, it's been a wonderful time talking with you. You have indeed taught and instructed me, and I'm sure many of our listeners too will experience the same thing. Thank you for a wonderful exposition of the work that you've been doing. You are truly a leader and legend of online learning.
Mark, thank you very, very much for giving me the chance to get behind my, the chancel at the in the Church of Good Learning and deliver my sermon.
Brilliant. Thank you. You'll find more about Paul and links to his work from our website. His Twitter handle is p_a_kirshner. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website www.onlinelearninglegends.com to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.